Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Enquiry. My special guest tonight is legendary guitarist Cliff Goodwin. He has a new album out, Cliff Goodwin Rhythm and Blues Union. Double it up. Cliff, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this for probably, not that I even calculated, but probably 2 or 3 decades.
The amazing thing is, people don't know that before we went on this interview together, we were off on a tangent you would not believe. We were talking about the music of our era, and we were really spoiled. Really spoiled, and didn't know it. But let's talk about your album is so good.
Thank you very much.
Cliff Goodwin, Rhythm and Blues Union, Double It Up. Now, this was recorded at Abbey Road Studios, and not to be like a fawning fan, but I have to ask you, walking into that studio, is it still have the mat? Did you still feel it?
You can't get away from it, Mark. I mean, you see, the beautiful thing about Abbey Road is, first of all, I've recorded in most amazing studios in the world. You know, the Hit Factory, Criteria Studios in Miami, Air Studios in London, the Sunset Sound out in Los Angeles. And so the most amazing thing about Abbey Road was it was the best studio I've ever recorded in my life.
Wow.
So it's not only a high-functioning studio, but also it is a shrine. Huh. And you never lose sight of that because the ghost of either Lennon or McCartney or those other two guys they're on your shoulder. And we cut the tracks in Studio 2. If anyone out there is a real Beatle fan, they've seen pictures of the Beatles in Studio 2 where there's this long stairway that goes up to the control room. And it's still there. They haven't changed a thing. As a matter of fact, there's a corridor that you can take pictures of. They saved all the old recording machines. You can actually take a picture of the machine they did Sgt. Pepper on.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So now, in that backdrop, here we come to set up and start to record a record. It was otherworldly. I'll just leave it at that. it's an absolute incredible blessing, without a doubt.
Let's talk about the lineup on this record. You do lead vocals, lead guitar, slide, Nashville high strung, and acoustic guitar. Who's the rest of the band?
Okay, on drums we have Marty Richards, who is probably one of the best drummers, as far as I'm concerned, in the world.
Yep.
He's played with everybody from Joe Perry to the Jay Giles Band. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you his full resume. On bass we had Wolf Hernandez, who's played with incredible amount of soul chestnut guys, just another veteran. On saxophone, we had Derek Dyer, who played with us with Joe Carker and also with Tina Turner. And then my brother from another mother, Mitch Shakur, who I've been with
for a long time, man.
Since high school. And then the young lady singing with us, Annie Lang Nicholson, who we met back in days when we first started with Joe Carker back in the late 70s, and we found her singing with this Tulsa. She's from Tulsa. We found her singing with this guy, other guy from Tulsa you may have heard, named Leon Russell. That's the band. And, I mean, a good – we're all brothers and sisters. And the ringleader was my very old friend, one of our original, the original sound man from the original American Standard Band. We know him as Peach, but his actual name is Rich Nealon. But
good old Rich.
But I'm sorry, it's going to be Peach. So if I refer to, if you in this interview hear me speaking of a fruit, that's a verb, not an adjective, and it's Peach.
Now he goes way back with you.
Yeah, sure, 69, 70, yeah. The original American Standard was, together around that time, sure.
Okay, don't get me started on American Standard yet.
Okay.
I want to stay with this record. Talk to me about the cuts you decided to play.
The songs I chose?
Yep, the 8. And I think that's the most interesting one is the last one, Big Indian.
Well, again, if
sort of mysterious.
We had finished pretty much recording, and Sue Ann, my wife, said, "Well, don't you think we need maybe something else just to finish the sentence, you know, to put a period on it?" And I said, "Yeah, maybe a lullaby kind of song." And at the time, a very good friend of mine, who was in a band called the Rhinestones, mm-hmm. he had an amazing career himself. His name was Cal David. Around that time, we lost him. Cal passed away. And so I said to Sue Ann, my wife, you know, how about this? We'll dig out a Cal tune called Big Indian. And that was the tune we did for the last track. And me and Mitch kind of threw it together in half an hour and did it.
Now, is this group going to tour?
You'd have to define tour.
Travel around and play?
Well, again, you and I being the roughly the same age,
yep,
of a certain age, and all our friends and players are roughly the same thing.
And it's tough getting everybody together to tour.
Well, it's not only that. It's that tour to me is basically making it from the kitchen to the living room the adequate time provided. I don't foresee us.
Yeah, I think touring is one of those things you do in your youth.
Well, it's a young man's game.
Yeah,
I mean, we
especially nowadays.
In the old days when we were doing it on a regular basis, you could swan up to an airline counter in 10 minutes before and just walk on the plane.
Yeah.
You know, now you got to take your socks off and
yep.
everything else. You know.
And also venues are really tough to come by. Unless you're playing like some mega crazy venue.
Now that COVID has passed,
yeah.
I'll put that in quotes because we really don't know, but we hope. Everything is opening up like crazy. But again, to get all of us together,
it's tough.
To go anywhere is a chore, you know. What can I say? It's touring is a young man's game.
Yep, I totally get it. Now, please tell me you're going to write a memoir. I'm putting you on the air to commit to this.
Yeah,
because your long history is so interesting, and I'm sure you have a ton of stories.
Well, I'm going to write a memoir, Mark. I really am. I'm also going to tell you that I'm lying.
Come on, Cliff. Come on.
Well, my old boss, Joe Cocker, used to say to me, Cliff, you should write the book because you're the only one who remembers.
But that's right.
That was a while ago. He said that to me. Of course, we don't have him anymore. God bless him. But that was a while ago. And since he said that, I've forgotten that he said it because I don't remember. It'd be fun, but I think it'd be fun for you and me. So we'll.
No. I think it's important in the history of rock, and I mean that sincerely. I think we need more sort of personal memoirs of especially the time period when you start out right up through today. I mean, you were in a lot of critical places, and also I love the story of you starting out as a high school student in bands. What was the first band you were in? It was a Beatles cover band, wasn't it?
Actually not. Strange that you mentioned that because although at one point Joe and I sat down and we counted how many times I had done with a little help from my friends with him.
Now, the band was called The Exit Left?
Yeah, The Exit Left. What I was going to say about the Beatles is I never did any Beatles songs with any bands I was in.
Really?
No, but ironically, I played... with a little help from my friends, with Joe Cocker, over 2,000 times.
Wow! Well, tell that, Kitty. Can I ask you about The Exit Left? No, that was your first band. How old were you?
Oh, 12.
Now, where's this band playing?
Where did Exit Left play?
Yeah.
Well, keep in mind, Mark, in 1965, this was just after the Beatles were really starting to hit.
Yeah, the British invasion's going on.
Exactly. All you had to have was four guys with a pulse.
That's right. That's right.
You know, if you had a guy that in his attic, in the back of his attic, there was a snare drum, he became the drummer. It had nothing to do with whether you knew how to play. So we had our first band was called the Exit Left, yeah, and we had guys that wanted to play. But you got work right away.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, we started at 12 or 13 years old. We were playing fraternity parties.
That's exactly right.
You know, someone said, that's illegal. I said, well, what's changed?
What was your first guitar?
It was actually an acoustic guitar. Again, it was up in the attic. I think it was my aunt's guitar that she never continued to play. And it was an acoustic guitar. But
how about your first electric guitar?
My first electric guitar was, I think it was called a Howard guitar.
Are you pulling my leg?
No, $1.98, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, $1.98 version. It didn't. And then pretty rapidly I graduated to, you really want to know about this stuff?
I'm fascinated by this. It's these details that really, really fascinate me.
Yeah, the second guitar was a guitar called the Kappa Continental, which I guess that they say now are fairly collectible, you know. And then after that, I graduated to a Gibson 335.
Yeah. Okay.
Matter of fact, I found recently a receipt. I bought that guitar from a guy by the name of Joe DeAngelo, who was also in a very popular band in the Worcester area called the Joneses at the time.
Huh.
And it was a receipt from Fred DeAngelo, Joe's father, to my grandmother, Victoria DeBrilla, for $400 or something like that. And the receipt stated right on, it was in her handwriting, it said that Clifford will reimburse his grandmother from the proceeds from his engagements. Sometimes you stumble upon these things.
Now, one of the founding members of the American Standard Band, I think that's when most people first started to hear from you. Can you talk to me how you got together in the American Standard Band?
You're forgetting a very important band in the Worcester County area called The End.
Yes, you're right.
A band called The End, which had three members of the eventual American Standard Band in it.
Good name, too.
The End?
Yeah.
I always thought it was rather final.
And but, now, The End.
You know, we had a van, and the van on the front of it said, "Here comes the end." And in the back of it, they painted, "There goes the end."
I could see that one coming.
Yeah. No, it's true.
I love it.
Blue.
In the end, so to speak, what are you playing? Are you playing any original compositions?
No, not really. There was an inkling of that on the horizon. But really, keep in mind, we're playing dances, Mark.
Yep.
People want to dance.
So they want to hear covers.
You know, Soul Chestnuts, Hold On, I'm Coming, and Tobacco Road, and, you know, Daddy Rolling Stone. If you even look at the early footage of, let's talk about The Who.
Yeah.
You know, now we all know about The Who. But they called themselves a rhythm and blues dance band.
When their early stuff, yeah.
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 So we were all doing the same thing. You were doing dances. I mean, the gigs everybody was doing were...
You had to gig, because what else are you doing it for? You're doing it for a gig.
We were doing it for... It was just a strange kind of passion.
Yeah.
I mean, that I can look back on it now, and it was a double-edged passion. It was a curse and a blessing, but certainly a passion. You know, you put hours and hours and hours of total immersion into listening to music, playing music, thinking about music.
People have got to also realize that time period, because that was the first time. I mean, we're talking about the mid to late 60s and early 70s eventually.
Yes.
But
yep.
Rock became king at that point.
Oh, totally. It was. But
and so to be part of that was huge.
Well, again, you never realize it until after the fact.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Like we were watching the other night, a concert for George, or they just recently had a beautiful tribute to Jeff Beck.
Yep.
And I'm saying, Royal Albert Hall, we played there.
Yeah.
You know, I remember playing there. I remember they right to my left, they actually sat people practically on the stage. They were, 10, 15 feet from you. I remember having conversations. You guys having fun? Is it you're enjoying it? You know.
Wow.
It was. kind of crazy.
It was a lot more intimate.
Well, it was real. You were all in it together.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, back in that the late 60s, the time you refer to, like late 60s, early 70s, the commerce had not devoured artistry yet.
Yeah, there was no such thing as arena rock.
It was approaching, because you know Zepp, and you know there were there wasn't arena rock per se.
We were talking about the bands that we saw at the different colleges at that time, and you know Atwood Hall sits just a couple of hundred people.
Yeah, well, I think Alden Hall held about 500.
Yeah,
but that was nothing. Alden Hall at
WPI, yeah.
Same thing, but then you had the gym at Assumption.
Yep.
Could maybe hold 1,000 Harrington Auditorium. I knew all these venues because I snuck into every one of them.
And that was the other thing, is you could actually sneak into venues.
Oh, well, of course you could. I mean, there was we were urchins. We were teenage urchins wandering around the neighborhood.
Okay, let's get back to American Standard.
I'm sorry.
No, don't ever apologize. So talk to me about the beginning of American Standard.
Well, I started a band with the bunch of guys from different part of the city up on Vernon Hill, Grafton Street, called Albatross.
I remember Albatross.
Yeah. And they eventually went on to be quite popular in the area.
Yep.
But it kind of floundered. You know, back then, what seemed like forever was really a couple weeks.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
You can reference your old girlfriends, you know. Well, it seemed like I went out with her forever, but it only was a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks of hell sometimes.
But a couple of weeks was normal, and it seemed like forever.
Exactly. So after Albatross, you'd find your way to other people. You talk, you chat. Hey, you want to play with me? Yeah, okay, I'll come join your band. You know what I mean? Nobody was thinking, long term. You were hoping for long term, but you weren't thinking it, you know.
So how did American Standard form?
Well, a guy named Kevin Falvey was really...
I knew Kevin. Kevin was a friend.
Yeah, he went to Clark. He was really the leader. Originally, American Standard was a general business band. They did weddings and stuff
like that.
But after they hired me, they started to expand a little bit into more of a rock format, but they still wouldn't let me play till the last set.
Why?
I was too loud. You know, they wouldn't, certainly when we were doing weddings, they wouldn't let me play till the last set. They were afraid I'd scare the wedding party.
Well, who were your musical influences at that time?
Oh, totally. I mean, that's easy. The British Invasion, you know.
Yep, yep.
Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page. And then even more, I could name them forever, you know, for everybody coming from the UK. I was totally taken with, Zeppelin, Cream, the Jeff Beck group. A band called Free.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, so it was totally that. You know?
American Standard Band became big.
We were, I guess, popular in...
Yeah, you were popular.
...with the county.
And you had, more than that, you had T-shirts.
We did?
You did.
Okay. I don't remember that.
Have T-shirts, because I saw them, I had one.
Wow, that's pretty good.
There's something that made T-shirts about you that didn't cut you in.
Did it say the American Standard Band, or did it say American Standard?
Right, the plumbing supply.
Well, we got sent a cease and desist letter from the plumbing company.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, recommending. I think it read something like, "We suggest that you do not use our name for your band."
Did you cease and desist?
Yeah. Well, we did. We changed it to the American Standard Band. You know, rather than just American Standard.
You ended up playing out. Your guitar playing just became amazing.
And thank you.
And you played out for so long, for so many years, with really in major bands. You had 12 years or almost 12 years with Joe Cocker.
Yep.
I have to ask you, I mean, did that normalize to you that you were there with him?
Well, you know, I'd have to say, you know, yes, but at the same time, when you look back on it, it was a long time to be with one act, you know.
It was, and especially an act of that caliber.
Yeah, I mean, we were traveling. It was Joe was an international star.
Right.
So, you know, we were. I mean, I've been to Australia 5 times.
Jesus.
And that's not easy. You know, Japan and all through Europe. Joe is very, very popular in Europe. You know, South America. There's not a lot of places we haven't been.
You also play guitar in a lot of his major hits that were recorded.
I played on a number of them. Joe's thing from the beginning of his career right to the end was he didn't use one band. He always used a number of players, which was really cool as being in his band because it was the best education for me ever to be eventually know how to do recording sessions.
Yeah.
Because Joe's, all his repertoire spanned the rock, almost jazz,
yep,
certainly rhythm and blues, certainly regular blues, even reggae. So we had to have a handle on all those things. So
that must have been a great learning experience, too.
Unbelievable. Beyond. And then, of course, you're playing with different people throughout the years, either in the studio or actually on the gigs. And, you know, you osmosis, you absorb these vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read that he taught you how to serve the song. Can
serve
you explain explain that to me and to the audience?
Well, you know, the most important thing we're talking about is the song. Nobody ever had a hit record because the snare drum sounded good. You know, it's the song. And so
now I have to go and see if I can find one. Okay.
You might find a hit record that the snare drum does sound good, but the song is still there.
That's right. Okay.
And so that's the point. And Joe made us understand early on that the song is the most important thing.
So no, like, look at me, I'm going to do a huge guitar solo unless it serves the song.
Exactly. Guitar solos or any kind of solos are very nice, but they have to serve the song.
Now, as you move through life, how did you start to find the people that you wanted to gig with the most?
Luck.
Okay.
Sometimes, you know, luck or happenstance, or, you know, just...
I mean, that becomes important as a musician, right? That you want to find those people that you feel like you can just drop in and they get it.
Well, I've been blessed. I've been so blessed, Mark. I mean, it's... I can't even, you know, that my... I get to play on a regular basis with my friends who I've known for 4 or 5 decades... who also happen to be unbelievable.
I know.
You know, so how can you beat that?
So first of all, there's a comfort level.
On every level you could imagine, we're talking about. Every level you could imagine. You know, you can hang out with them, you can have a laugh, you can play music. You know, we each finish each other's sentences, you know. And then, of course, to bring them full circle now, to bring everybody to London to Abbey Road was beyond. I can't even describe it.
So egos don't get in the way.
No, not with our gang. You know, everybody knows what they can do. Knows that everybody has their musical back. Their friends have their musical back, and everyone will get a chance to shine. You know.
Now I'm reading that you just did guitars on some new material from Orpheus?
Yeah, I was.
You got to tell me about that because that's wild.
Well, Bruce Arnold, the guy in American Standard, who one of the members of American Standard, also played with us with Joe Cocker. His name was Howie Hirsch, another Worcester guy.
Yeah.
And Howie Hirsch contacted me a few years now back because of COVID disrupted everything to play on, I think, the last Orpheus track ever recorded. Called Man Alive.
Wow.
I don't even know if it ever came out. It was because Bruce was ill. You know, Bruce Arnold was ill.
Yeah.
Major voice. Wow. Yeah. So that's the story there. Howie, you know, called me up and said, "Well, you want to put guitars on this?" I said, "Are you kidding me?" Yeah, absolutely. And then Bruce.
Oh, by the way, I have to interrupt for people who aren't old enough to remember. Orpheus was huge back in the 60s.
Oh, the big hit was Can't Find the Time.
Can't Find the Time to Love You.
Yeah.
But it's also It was a Worcester band. There was a thing about Congress Alley on their first album.
They were part of that what they call the Boston
Sound. The Boston Sound. Can you name one other band that was part of the Boston Sound?
I can name all three of them.
Okay.
Morpheus, Ultimate Spinach, and Beacon Street Union.
It's the Eyes of the Beacon Street Union.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Cliff.
Well, do I get the prize?
Checks in the mail.
You get a full week expense paid trip to Auburn.
But there was this thing. It was obviously created by the writers, the Boston Sound.
Okay. I think they were all on MGM, the label.
I think
MGM
you're right. I think you're right.
As far as I'm concerned, Orpheus was head and shoulders above the other two.
Now, you have another album out.
The
Trilby album, isn't it?
Yeah, that was a project that we did during COVID when we couldn't go to London.
Yep. And that's another great album, though. This is aces.
Thank you.
I popped this in while we were driving in the car, and it was we just listened to it beginning to end.
Great.
Yeah. And not only is your guitar playing superb, but the recording quality is like, whoa.
Well, Abbey Road.
Yeah, I know.
There's a standard of excellence that is, again, what you, I guess, when you step back from it and take it out of context, it's what you'd expect.
We're completely out of time. And we could obviously talk for hours and hours, so I'll have to have you back again.
Just name the time.
Yeah, my special guest tonight is legendary guitarist Cliff Goodwin, and he's got a brand new album out. It is really worth your attention. Cliff Goodwin, Rhythm and Blues Union, double it up. Cliff, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.